Merry Christmas Eve, everybody. This is the Solid Monster, and this is Sound Off 94 on SCScoops.com. It is Thursday, December 24th, 2009. Christmas Eve, a special weekday holiday edition of the podcast here during this very festive time of year. Whether you celebrate Christmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, or nothing at all, I do hope wherever you are, you do have a very enjoyable holiday spent with friends, family, or alone, whatever makes you happy. But we're going to do things a little bit differently today, just a little bit. I am going to start and just give my a quick rundown of Raw this past Monday night, a horrendous show. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to give out some awards, sort of the sound-off version of the Slammies, only with no real fancy title. Just a look back at 2009 in World Wrestling Entertainment, looking at things like, you know, the matches and the feuds of the year and angles and, you know, announcers and divas and guest hosts and things of that nature. And just talking about the best and worst, basically. And God knows there was a lot of bad stuff this year, but there was also a lot of good. And so it's only worthwhile here to kind of look back on that and see what 2009 really was all about. And I'm going to get to that a little bit later on. But let me just start with this Monday Night Raw show from this past week. Raw emanated from Tampa, Florida. Guest hosted by Johnny Damon, who is a free agent right now and may not come back to the Yankees. But as of this past season, he did play for the New York Yankees. And, in fact, he won a World Series title with the Yankees. He also won a World Series title with the hated rivals of the Yankees, the Boston Red Sox, a couple of years ago. So Johnny Damon gets around, and he's a big-time wrestling fan. In fact, I think he did an angle on TV once with TNA, where he actually gave somebody a chair shot, if I remember. So he's a big wrestling fan. But unfortunately, Johnny Damon is not a very enthusiastic person. Anybody that would watch him give an interview before or after a baseball game would be able to tell you that. So why WWE thought he would make for a great personality to put in the middle of the ring and read their scripted material, I do not know. I could see, I guess, if it was kind of an A-list celebrity, you know, you just want to get them on the show somehow, even if they suck. Well, Johnny Damon is not an A-list celebrity. He's a regional, I guess, I say regional in that he's a sports athlete that only some people are going to know. It's not like he had this great, outstanding personality. So whatever. He was one of the worst Raw hosts that we've had. Not the worst, but he was one of the bad ones. He just, he looked wooden, he looked a little nervous. He sounded like he was reading from scripted material, and that's never a good thing. The best people are given scripted material and make it sound like it's their own words. Johnny Damon did not do this. So we had the stupid stuff on the show, as you might imagine. We had the person in the tiger costume being chased around by a blonde. Of course, a spoof on the Tiger Woods situation, only a couple of weeks too late. And in fact, I think that spoof was actually a ripoff of something that the NFL did. So, way to go, WWE. So, this literally happened. They ran backstage. Johnny Damon made a face, shrugged his shoulders, and moved on. So this meant absolutely nothing at all. Nobody laughed. Everybody was just kind of like, what the fuck is this doing here? And so the show continued. Let's see here. He announced the Divas match, which of course went about a minute and a half at most, meant nothing. As these things unfortunately usually do, they just don't give the women that much time, so the matches mean nothing. And then we got Little People's Court. I'm sure you've been waiting now for weeks with bated breath. We've been teased now for no less than 3 weeks waiting for Little People's Court. Originally, Shawn Michaels and Triple H got served, and they were to appear for court a week later. That was 3 weeks ago, so somehow they kept delaying the trial, I guess you would call it. And tonight was the night, Monday night that is, that we finally got Vince McMahon's idea of high comedy. Now, I'm sure that there are people out there who thought this was legitimately funny. I mean, I'm almost positive that those people exist. I hope that none of those people are listening to this podcast right now. There were elements of humor to this. I'm not saying the whole thing was completely unfunny, but I don't see how anybody with half a brain could watch this thing from start to finish and think, wow, that was hilarious. That was great. And obviously these things are not meant to further a storyline or, you know, push a pay-per-view or anything. Well, I guess it was used to further a storyline. We got Hornswoggle ultimately made up with DX, and now he's their mascot. And the only thing I could hope is that it eventually leads to a heated feud where DX feuds with a team that just beats the shit out of the midget to get sympathy out of the fans. I guess that would work, but this whole thing was just... It's the sort of thing where if I were watching Raw, and let's just say if somebody walked in to the room as I was watching the TV show, I would be embarrassed to be watching Monday Night Raw. I'd probably rush to the remote control to turn it off. That's usually not a good thing. The one saving grace of this entire little people's court crap was Shawn Michaels, and that seems to be a consistent factor with all of these DX skits that they do. Shawn Michaels is so over the top. He oversells everything. He's genuinely funny. Not all the time, but Shawn Michaels can save a segment. Big shocker, I know. Now, that's not to say Triple H is not a funny guy. Triple H may be a lot of things, but he certainly is a funny, witty, sarcastic person. I chuckle at Triple H's barbs sometimes, and he's allowed to get away with saying certain things I think that other people wouldn't. But this was not funny, you know. Coming underneath the ring and then, of course, looking for Hornswoggle, and it's dark under the ring, and they put the lights on, and they're in an area backstage that looks shockingly like the backstage area of any arena you've ever seen in your life. And, you know, they go into the little courtroom. I swear I did not say that on purpose. That just came out. But it was a little courtroom. That's what it was. It wasn't, you know, I had heard that in other cities over the last couple of weeks when they were going to originally do the segment, they rented out actual courthouses. And I had heard that they had done the same here. And apparently they decided, you know, ixnay on the Orthouse K, and they just decided to use a room backstage, which was probably for the better. And so, of course, the jury is consisting entirely of little people, as you might imagine. Including one with a receding hairline, and of course there's a joke about Shawn Michaels' hair that Triple H likes to make, much like Shawn usually rags on Triple H's big nose. Funny stuff. Anyway, the one thing I don't get, I've heard Hornswoggle talk before on TV. I could swear, like, just early in his run, maybe even back when he was Little Bastard, that he actually would speak a few words like normal English. Maybe I'm just imagining things. I know I've heard him, you know, give interviews, and obviously when he gives interviews outside the ring, he sounds like a normal guy. But apparently little people can't speak. They grunt like little gremlins, and so whatever. They showed footage from the last 6 weeks, 6 months, it felt like, of Hornswoggle DX stuff and the Madison Square Garden thing where they pedigreed the little midget. I was there. The crowd did not know how to react to that. And so, basically fast-forwarding a little bit, because they actually divided this into two different parts, and they replayed a majority of the goddamn thing later in the show, as if this wasn't bad enough. So the verdict is guilty. Now, I don't know about you, I don't pledge to know too much about law. I was not a law student. If I was, I'm sure I'd be making far more money than I do now, but is it just me, or is it not a situation where, when you're in a civil trial, you don't render a verdict of guilty or not guilty? Apparently they were on trial for murder or some sort of felony of some kind. Maybe it was felony assault on Hornswoggle. Anyway, they're guilty. Shawn Michaels, of course, determines this just based on the little midget Judge Judy wannabe whatever banging her gavel, and apparently that means guilty. And Shawn Michaels does his classic overselling. Maybe the best oversell I've seen Shawn do since the match with Hogan at SummerSlam in 2005. Just good stuff. So the midgets start throwing paper plates and cups and napkins and whatever other paraphernalia at DX, who, of course, they can't take the paper plates and stuff and cups being thrown at them, so they run away. And you know, it was kind of amusing, I guess, when they run out of the locker room and all the little midget hands are coming out like a zombie movie or something, and then they run and they come back out from under the ring, and they you know, Shawn Michaels is being dragged back under, and he's like, I could feel their little hands on my legs. You know, that was kind of funny, but the whole thing was a colossal waste of time, just like we knew it would be. I don't know what the point of any of this was. You know, you have 7 weeks coming out of the TLC pay-per-view, they had 7 weeks of time to start plugging the Royal Rumble. And I can understand you're not going to do too much of a hard sell the first week or two because you've got so much time between now and January 31st. But you would think the Royal Rumble is one of their bigger events of the year. Their pay-per-view buy rates are in the toilet. With this extra time, they would start planting seeds for the Royal Rumble and pushing towards the Royal Rumble pay-per-view. And apparently their attitude, just based on, you know, the way they're booking these TV shows the last week or two is, you know, holy shit, there's a lot of time between now and the Rumble, and so why don't we just kill a couple of weeks, and, you know, 10 days before the pay-per-view, we'll start to get serious and we'll start to plug some real matches for it. So, I hope that's not the case. I'm still excited about January 4th, and all that, but just not good stuff. I can't, you know, go crazy about it because we knew what we were going to get. I wasn't expecting an Academy Award winning, you know, dramatic performance. I knew we were going to get garbage, and garbage is what we got. It was amusing at times, but just the sort of thing that I think anybody over the age of 20 just kind of blushes and shudders and cringes at, because maybe little kids get a kick out of it, but, you know, I'm not a little kid. You're not a little kid. And it just makes you wonder, maybe I'm getting too old for this shit. And that's not good, because if I feel that way, I bet you there's a whole lot of other people out there who feel the same way. It was also after the segment ended, and I mentioned this on my Twitter page, I was doing a little bit of live blogging during Raw on twitter.com/Solomonster, for those of you who are not yet following me. And I think I mentioned something about how Bret Hart, right about now, is probably hoping that if he did not ask for or request a clause in his contract for creative control, he's probably wishing he had after watching that segment. I'm willing to bet that. There was a six-man tag that involved Legacy against Mark Henry, Evan Bourne, and Kofi Kingston. Was not very encouraged to see Kofi come out with a couple of jobbers, basically. Let's be honest, that's how Evan Bourne and Mark Henry have been booked of late. But I really enjoyed this match. It was a really good six-man tag, and I was shocked to see Kofi get the pin on DiBiase at the end. So there may yet be hope for young Kofi Kingston. It looked like his push had been killed dead, and he was kind of sliding right back down into mid-card hell where he was before. The guy needs to at least be an upper mid-carder. If he's not going to be a bona fide main eventer just yet, the guy cannot afford to be losing all the time. And so him beating Ted, who's got a movie coming out next week on DVD, in case you didn't know, was refreshing, and it gives me hope that this Orton-Kofi program is not yet over, and it will continue through the Rumble, and who knows, maybe even into WrestleMania. We'll see. But I did enjoy the six-man tag, and, believe it or not, I enjoyed a John Cena match. I thought the match he had with Jack Swagger was really good. Another thing that shocked me, Jack Swagger, another young guy on the roster who had gotten a push and then had his push killed dead for whatever reason. Vince McMahon just soured on him. He didn't do anything wrong. But Swagger has been booked almost like a jobber for several weeks now. He had that little win streak that he started, and within a few weeks it was over. So then they gave John Cena the whole win streak gimmick, which it looks like after a couple of weeks that may be coming to an end as well. We'll get to that later. But I was surprised to see, and pleasantly so, to see Swagger get as much offense in on Cena as he did. He dominated that match, even though Cena won, which you knew he had to, but this was a good match. And, you know, it's the sort of thing, and I don't want to take anything away from Sheamus, because I think so far so good. He's doing a good job. I think Sheamus can grow into the role as champion. You know, obviously he was given the title way too soon. I don't know that he deserves the title so quickly over some other young guys that have been around more than, you know, longer than he has. But I have no problem with Sheamus as champion, because it's something different. It keeps the belt off Cena for now. And I think Sheamus has done a pretty good job. I mean, he hasn't looked out of place. He doesn't seem too nervous. He doesn't speak much, but when he speaks, he's fine. Having said that, I just can't help but wonder and even shake my head that, you know, they didn't give Jack Swagger that spot. Because Swagger's been around a little bit longer, former ECW champion. He's got that collegiate background. There's something about Swagger I like in many respects, and I don't know that it's just the amateur background, but he reminds me of Brock Lesnar, and I mean that in a good way. And Swagger is more advanced in the ring as a performer than Sheamus is. And, you know, his match with Cena showed that the two of them have chemistry. They can have a very good match. And it's, you know, to me it's almost a shame that they didn't give, you know, if they were so intent on giving a younger guy a chance, that they didn't put the belt on Swagger instead and just keep building Sheamus up more and more as a monster. I mean, what's done is done. It's not a big deal. And I think Sheamus will continue to improve. But after that match was over, I just couldn't help but think, man, the wrong guy got the belt at TLC. The Secret Santa stuff all night was kind of silly. I mean, we got to see Sergeant Slaughter, who I guess is supposed to be gay now, and we saw Dusty Rhodes with the polka dot, which was kind of cute. And we saw IRS, and, you know, IRS mentioning the baseball players are the biggest tax cheats in the world was funny because it's true. Looking at you, Derek Jeter. Not so perfect after all, are you? I think he got all those issues cleared up. Anyway, Mae Young, of course, makes her obligatory appearance once every 6 months. It's good to see Mae, although I was a little disturbed. Not just by what she, you know, her assault on a young Johnny Damon, but you'll notice that when Mae went to get up off the floor, she almost fell back down. I mean, Mae Young is 86 years old, and, you know, it's good for her, I guess, to make an appearance every now and then and not wrestle. I hope her wrestling days are over. I know she mentioned a while ago that when she turns 100, she wants to wrestle Aurora Rose, Stephanie and Triple H's daughter, who I think turns 18 when Mae, or 17, when Mae turns 100. She wants to wrestle her in a match. And I hope to God that Mae is still around, but I do not want to see her wrestle. So, whatever. We got Mae Young wishing everybody a Merry Christmas. She didn't say Happy Hanukkah, but that's okay. My feelings are not hurt. The least she could have done was wish everybody a Happy Festivus for the rest of us. Sheamus beat MVP in a squash. This made me sad. Not that Sheamus won, because you knew he would and he has to, but MVP just looks like a jobber now. And he's much better than that. And we had Cena come out. Cena wanted to do... I almost thought for a second that Cena had Money in the Bank. He wanted to cash in on his title shot. You know, if he has a rematch, why didn't he ask for it the night after? So Cena wants his rematch. Sheamus backs off. Not because he's a coward, but because he's smart. Way to go, Sheamus. If I were him, I would stay as far away from John Cena as possible. Unfortunately, that's not going to be possible because Johnny Damon went and signed the Cena-Sheamus rematch for the championship on Raw next Monday night, when Timbaland will guest host the show. This troubles me. Let me finish the little Raw review here. We had The Miz. He wrestled Santino Claus. It was a complete waste. And then the main event was not much of a main event at all, really. Big Show came out. It was really campy, corny crap. Chris Jericho came out dressed as Santa, did a great impression of the Queen of England, I guess, or Stewie Griffin from Family Guy, whoever the hell he was trying to impersonate. It was pretty funny, but you know, sitting on Big Show's lap and then all the campy crap Big Show, you know, oh, Santa, you know, I want my best, whatever. So the midgets came out, a little DX army of midgets, and I did take great pleasure in watching Big Show give that one midget a side slam. I mean, I had memories, throwbacks to WrestleMania 3, Little Beaver, and King Kong Bundy. Obviously, there were not 93,000 or 78,000 people, really, in the crowd on Monday night, but it was still equally enjoyable. And then DX came out, cleaned house. Hornswoggle was, I guess, inducted into DX as a mascot. And here's the thing that troubles me. Now, I'm not offended by any of this because, yeah, I'm a young guy, relatively speaking. And, you know, I very much enjoyed most aspects of the Attitude Era when the product was a lot edgier. And I, like many of you, were not the biggest fan of this PG-rated version of WWE. But there's something wrong when the company clearly is pushing themselves as a PG product. There's no blood allowed anymore. Obviously, the language is a lot tamer, and the storylines are a lot tamer and campier than they've been in many, many years. And a lot of that has to do with Linda McMahon running for Senate, but whatever the reason, the product is definitely more youth-oriented. And, you know, you can say about DX that they get the crowd the chant "suck it" every week, even though you never really hear Triple H or Shawn Michaels say the word "suck it." But here's Hornswoggle, who is one of the most popular characters in the entire company, sells a shitload of merchandise. The kids love him. That's why he's around. He's a kid's character. If there was ever a character on TV to not have chant the words "suck it," it would be Hornswoggle. And yet, that's exactly what they do. They have Hornswoggle get on the mic and go, "suck it." So apparently he can't speak English. But that kind of troubled me. If I had a kid, I might be a little concerned about that. I mean, anybody else saying "suck it" is one thing, but to have Hornswoggle of all people, suck what? Suck what exactly? So that was kind of dumb. That may come back to bite them on the asses too, as far as Linda is concerned, but that's their problem, not mine. It's her money. She can do whatever she wants with it. So basically, that was Raw in a nutshell. Chris Jericho is back already after 1 week, and you wonder why stipulations don't mean jack shit. you know, John Cena does this gimmick. I'm not going to lose a match until I win back the title. And then 2 weeks later, he gets a title shot. You know, just stuff like this is why matches and stips just don't matter anymore. Now, back to Cena and Sheamus. I was very concerned on Monday night, less so now, but nonetheless, I certainly share in the concern of many of you that we are perhaps going to see Sheamus drop the belt right back to Cena next week. I was pleasantly surprised when Sheamus didn't drop the belt on the Slammy show the night after the pay-per-view, and I was thinking, all right, well, they'll probably keep it on him until the Royal Rumble, maybe. Even maybe the January 4th show. That's shaping up to be a pretty big night. So they signed the match for next week. First of all, I think that's a terrible idea because you should save the match for, if not January 4th, for the Royal Rumble. You know, he started this gimmick with Cena. He has to win a couple of matches at least before he gets a title shot. But no, he's getting a title shot next week. Now, originally I had heard that Cena would not be on the January 4th Raw. He had a commitment to appear, I think, at the Fiesta Bowl, which was an important kind of public appearance for him to make. I don't know in light of recent developments. You know, January 4th is obviously shaping up to be a very big night for wrestling. Maybe Cena will be on Raw after all. So maybe, let's say that Cena won't be on Raw. And so he's going to be at the Fiesta Bowl, and so they couldn't do the match then, so they wanted to do it next week. Fine. I hope to God, and I really, if you ask me, is Cena going to win, I'm going to say no. I really don't think they're that stupid. I know they're pretty stupid, but they can't possibly be that stupid and short-sighted to take the title off of Sheamus this quickly on a meaningless Raw. It's just not possible. Cena is also filming a role for a new movie, and he has not been appearing on house shows. In fact, I don't know that he's scheduled to be on any house shows, even into the month of January. And so if they were to put the belt back on Cena, that would not make a lot of sense to essentially take the belt and put it back on somebody who's not even appearing at house shows. Sheamus is on the house show lineups for January in singles matches against Shawn Michaels. Would make sense if that was your title match. Triple H is scheduled to face Big Show. Glad I don't have a ticket to any of those shows. But I really hope they're not that dumb to take the title off of Sheamus. It would kill Sheamus dead, number one. Number two, it's just way too soon. Number three, then what was the point of putting it on him in the first place? You know, you can make the argument that Sheamus won on a fluke, and so Sheamus is in a position now where he has to kind of prove that it wasn't a fluke. He beat MVP pretty dominantly on Monday night. Fine. He has to have a couple of more wins, a couple of more matches with people other than John Cena, and hold the belt longer to prove that it wasn't really a fluke. I fully expect Cena to get the belt back by the Royal Rumble, if not earlier. But to do a title change next Monday would be a big, 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 big mistake. I don't think they're going to. I'm going to guess that, you know, Sheamus gets DQ'd or there's some sort of non-decision. I certainly don't expect Sheamus to get a clean pinfall or submission victory over John Cena. There'll be some sort of gimmicked finish, I'm guessing, or non-finish. I don't care, quite frankly, what the finish is, as long as the finish involves Sheamus retaining the championship. That's the correct way to go about things. It doesn't matter that Sheamus is still green and probably did not deserve to have the belt put on him in the first place. But you know what? They did put the belt on him, and they've made a push, at least with him and I guess Kofi, although they've kind of botched that a little bit. But they're trying to get younger guys over, and that's commendable. I give them a lot of credit for that. The problem with WWE is that whenever it's kind of like one step forward, two steps back. They might have the right idea or the right concept or their intentions might be good, but then they go and fuck things up either because of politics or because they're just too stupid to realize that they're making the wrong move. If Sheamus lost the belt on Monday, that would be the wrong move. So I don't see that happening. I hope it doesn't happen. If it does, that's not good. It would be a huge mistake for them to do that. So I wouldn't get too concerned. I really don't think the title is coming off of Sheamus. Not yet. But I guess we'll see. That's your main event for Raw next Monday night. Timbaland is the guest host. Speaking of guest hosts, it still has not been confirmed by WWE directly, but I think it's pretty obvious that Bret the Hitman Hart will be back on the January 4th Raw as guest host. In fact, there are DirecTV listings for Raw on the 4th that are already listing Bret Hart. I think that the tagline is shocking guest host Bret the Hitman Hart returns to confront Mr. McMahon. So Bret Hart is coming back. That much we know 100% without question. I talked about that on the last podcast. Still don't have 100% confirmation that he'll be the guest host on the 4th, but I'd say I'm about 99% sure it will be him, and it will be fun. It will be fun. Bret, from what I understand, he's a little bit heavier. His back is in bad shape. I think he hurt his back recently. He's been, you know, training. I guess he's been in the gym. He wants to look good on TV. Anybody who hasn't really seen Bret Hart or a photo of Bret Hart recently that still remembers the Hitman from 1997 or 2000, you know, in WCW, needs to temper their expectations. Obviously, Bret Hart has gone through a lot. He was forced to retire due to some severe concussions. He suffered a stroke many years ago that he is mostly but not completely recovered from. His hair is a different color, unless he's going to dye it black again. Last I checked, it was kind of a light shade of brown, almost, or brunette. And he may not be in the Hitman shape from 10 years ago. But just to see Bret Hart back on TV, because it was such, it just seemed like such an impossibility, and so much time had gone by that people just stopped thinking about it. Although you never really didn't hear the rumors of, hey, Bret Hart's going to come back. I mean, that's been that way for years, but after a certain point, you know, it's been 10 years or whatever, it's been 12 years, you start to think, okay, it's just not going to happen. And we're going to see something that a lot of people thought was impossible. And so just the pop I think that Bret Hart will get walking out to his entrance music and the respect that he will hopefully get from that crowd in Dayton, Ohio, will hopefully be worth it. No matter what happens once the storyline kicks in and Bret gets in the ring and confronts Vince, because I don't really trust that WWE. You know, this is a potential storyline here with Bret. They can go in a million different directions with him. This is the same company that botched the Invasion of 2001. And some people might disagree with that. I'm not saying the Invasion was totally bad. In fact, we've gotten some pretty goddamn horrible WWE television in recent years that had me longing for the days of the Invasion, which I didn't enjoy at the time. So that says a lot. But this is the company that botched the Invasion. This is the company that gave us Little People's Court, among other, you know, crappy things. And so I'm not going to sit here and say that, well, whatever Bret Hart does is going to be great, because I don't know that WWE is going to go in the right direction. Or if they're going to, and then it gets spoiled and leaked on the internet, Vince McMahon may change his mind. But I'm looking forward just to seeing Bret back on WWE TV that first time, and then where it goes from there, I guess we'll see. They did announce that on January 11th, which is another competitive night for them, because Raw is going to be going head-to-head for the first time ever against a live UFC special on Spike. WWE pulling out the big guns will be bringing in Iron Mike Tyson as the guest host. Now, Mike Tyson was part of the big WWF turnaround in the late 1990s, when WWF was getting their ass handed to them by WCW. They paid Mike Tyson $3.5 million for basically what was a program. I mean, Mike was not on TV every week, but the contract they signed had Mike Tyson appearing at the Royal Rumble, appearing on Raw the next night. I think he appeared on two other Raw shows between the Rumble and WrestleMania, and then, of course, he was the guest enforcer for the WrestleMania main event between Shawn Michaels and Steve Austin, where, you know, after turning heel weeks earlier and joining DX, Tyson double-crossed DX and helped Austin win the belt, which will be interesting considering that all these years later they're bringing back Mike Tyson, and wouldn't you know it, DX is still on WWE TV, so again, it's a situation where I would love to see them follow up on that. You know, it's been so many years, 10, 11 years. You know, I'm sure Shawn Michaels looks back on that and is not terribly fond of the fact that Mike Tyson helped cost him the WWF title. Mike Tyson knocked him out. You would think that Shawn Michaels would get serious and would want to confront Iron Mike. And I could just easily see them putting Tyson in the ring with DX and building tension for a few seconds, and then DX just starts acting like a couple of goofballs and everybody's best friends. So I wouldn't get my hopes up about following up on that, but Mike Tyson's he's still a pretty big deal. Not a big deal the way he was 10, 15 years ago, but I think it'll pop a good rating. And he's definitely a personality that you never know what to expect from Iron Mike. All right, so on that note, let's shift into reflection mode here as we give a quick look back on World Wrestling Entertainment. I'm focusing on World Wrestling Entertainment because as much as we had a mix of good stuff and a lot of crap from WWE, they're still the number one promotion. And TNA is just, they go back and forth, and they move at such a ridiculous pace, I can't possibly remember much of what happened this year in TNA, so that's not going to happen. Hopefully, you know, TNA is pushing to really transform itself in 2010. I hope they do. So maybe I'll be doing a TNA year in review next year. But right now we're focusing on WWE. And, you know, 2009 was an interesting year for WWE. It was not their worst year. It was not their best year. It was just kind of another year. I think it was very similar in that respect to 2008. You know, nothing horrible happened, thank God, on the scale of what we saw in 2007 with the Benoit murders. Although there were a lot of names that passed away this year, and really just celebrities in general. This was just a horrible year for deaths. You know, even Brittany Murphy, in the last week or so. It's like, you know, the Reaper does not want to let go yet of 2009. But, business-wise, WWE, I think overall, looking back, did good. I know that over the course of the last year compared to last year, and I think more so because of the guest host concept, which only started in the summer, Raw's average rating, I believe, is actually up a bit this year from where it was last year, but Raw is still basically drawing the same ratings. It's not like the company saw some sort of huge decline or huge turnaround and a return to the glory days. It was almost a year of maintaining the status quo in many ways. Now, we got a lot of new things this year, an influx of new talent, obviously. More so, I think, towards the end of the year than the beginning of the year. I mean, people like Jack Swagger and CM Punk really came into their own, even though they were around in 08. The Miz really impressed me coming into his own as a singles performer. John Morrison, of course, got the big push as a babyface because they needed babyfaces on Friday nights, and I think he's a guy that, if he can stay healthy, is going to be a main event player in 5 years. Newer people like Drew McIntyre getting the big push, and Sheamus, of course, and Kofi Kingston has, you know, shed the Jamaican accent and is being pushed as a guy who I think has world title potential in the future. So we saw a lot of new talent, of course, ECW, Abraham Washington. I just never have to see this guy again. I'm waiting to see them, you know, let him wrestle. He is a wrestler, although they haven't used him in a match yet. Tony Atlas is the best part of his act, but I don't think anybody really can stand Abraham Washington. Yoshitatsu made a name for himself on the ECW brand. Christian, of course, continues to amaze. Christian made his comeback to World Wrestling Entertainment this year in February. And if you go back to the beginning of the year, it was interesting because Christian left TNA, I believe it was actually late 08, but he was all set to make his WWE return. And it was no secret that Christian was going to be brought back and connected with Edge, his storyline brother and former tag team partner, in the Edge-Jeff Hardy storyline. And Christian would make his big comeback at the Royal Rumble and would interfere and cost Jeff Hardy the championship in his match. And when plans were leaked, Vince McMahon flipped his lid and decided, well, now we have to swerve everybody and change things. And so they decided to do something that came back to bite them on the ass, much the same way it did back in 2001 when they tried it the first time. They decided to split up the Hardy Boys. So Matt Hardy started his 2009 by losing the ECW title to Jack Swagger. And later that night, during Jeff's match with Edge, and I'm sorry, Matt Hardy actually went into that match as the challenger now that I think about it. But anyway, so Matt Hardy basically gets Christian's spot, blasts his brother in the head with a chair. Matt Hardy turns heel and feuds with his brother. Nobody wanted to see it. Most people, I should say, did not want to see it. They had a couple of good matches, I will say that. The one match they had back in 01, which was the Vengeance match with Lita as a referee, was very disappointing and got crapped on. They had matches this year that were far better than that, including their WrestleMania match. A lot of crazy risks. Both guys really beat the crap out of each other. But at the end of the day, if you look back on Matt versus Jeff and you judge it, is it a fail or is it a win? It's a fail. Because it got abandoned pretty quickly after that. And there was no real explanation for it. They just kind of made up, or it was Matt Hardy, you know, asking his brother for forgiveness, and now he became his brother's biggest cheerleader, and it was really never spoken of again. So that was a fail. Christian, it was decided, would best fit on the ECW brand. And I will say this. I don't know how Christian really felt about it. If he felt it was a demotion, if he was disappointed, if he was happy to be working with the younger guys and to be able to carry a brand on his back. ECW is Christian. Christian is ECW. I hope that when they abandon ECW, which is going to happen at the beginning of the year at some point, Christian has moved on to, probably SmackDown would be his best bet, so he doesn't get lost in the shuffle on Raw, but this guy deserves, he deserves to be a main event player on a main event brand. Christian has done a phenomenal job this year. Just phenomenal. It is not the way that I would have brought Christian in. I think he works best as a heel, to be honest with you, and I certainly would not have put him in ECW, but he has made the most of the least. He's been the ECW champion now for quite some time. Probably the most impressive champion in WWE right now. He's had the belt for a while. Stole the show with Shelton Benjamin at the TLC pay-per-view recently. He's done a hell of a job. But I know a lot of people, myself included, were quite upset when we found out that Christian was put on ECW when he made his debut earlier this year. Now, as far as, you know, the Royal Rumble and stuff that happened at the beginning of the year, in terms of the main storyline, Randy Orton. Now, Orton's been around for a couple of years. But Randy Orton really came into his own this year. Orton is probably, if not the best, one of the best guys in the business right now. He's up there with Chris Jericho, as far as I'm concerned. Orton and Vince McMahon, that whole scenario that played itself out on the go-home edition of Raw before the Royal Rumble was great television. And it was great for a variety of reasons. It was great because in today's day and age, we don't often have a chance to see Vince McMahon get beaten up or embarrassed. Vince McMahon will make fun of himself now and then, and he will get embarrassed from time to time, and, you know, Stone Cold will make an appearance here and there and give him a stunner, but Vince McMahon back in, let's say, 1999, when he was wrestling more often, he was the heel, probably the top heel in the entire company, it was commonplace to see Vince get his ass kicked by Steve Austin, to get a rock bottom from The Rock, to get chokeslammed by The Undertaker, he had his ankle broken by Kane and The Undertaker on Raw back in 98. After a while, you kind of become numb to it. It doesn't mean as much as it used to, like when Vince got his first stunner. You know, oh my God, Vince McMahon, the owner of the company, took a big bump. And in recent years, it's been toned down quite a bit. Vince is not on TV as much, and Vince McMahon has almost morphed into this character that truly is larger than life. Back then, he was the owner of the company and all that, but people would stand up to him. And I think you see that less so now, not just because of his ego, but because he's the biggest guy in the company. He is the top dog. He is Mr. McMahon. And we don't see very many people kind of outdo him these days. So when Orton stood up to him and then, of course, slapped him in the face, kicked him in the head, in the skull, I should say, it was shocking television. Now, I don't know how shocking that would have been 10 years ago when Vince got beat up all the time. Plus, he was a heel back then. And Vince, I don't know what Vince is these days. He's one week he's a babyface, and now I guess with Bret Hart he's going to be a heel. But it was shocking. And that night, Vince was a babyface. And the crowd was shocked, I was shocked, and you thought, wow, this is huge. They're strapping the rocket on Randy Orton's back and shooting him up into the stars. Randy Orton had a fine year, don't get me wrong, and he became champion twice, but again, it's another missed opportunity. I see a pattern here, and not just in 2009, but WWE has had plenty of chances to really latch onto one star or one storyline and just run with it and make it big. And they always manage to fuck it up somehow. And I really think they fucked up the Randy Orton storyline. You know, the stuff with Randy Orton and Triple H, it felt fresh again. At the time, I couldn't stomach another Triple H-Randy Orton feud. But there was a new twist on it in that Orton was the heel, Triple H was the face, and they reintroduced Stephanie as a character. And so, you know, that night that Orton laid out Stephanie and handcuffed Triple H to the ropes and gave her a kiss, that was riveting television. And Orton plays his character so well. He's such a great heel. I really thought that was great stuff. Unfortunately, it went all downhill from there. Attacking Orton in his quote-unquote home, maybe that could have been really cool, but the way they handled it, it was so corny and so fake and so ridiculous. And it really just went downhill from there. And it didn't help that these guys were in the WrestleMania main event this year. We all know what the real main event was, but they decided to put Triple H and Orton on last. And much like Triple H and Chris Jericho at WrestleMania 18, who had to follow Hogan and The Rock, the match died a horrible death in front of the crowd. We saw a Triple H and Orton feud another month or two after that. It got to the point, much like with Cena and Orton later in the year, where I just did not want to see Triple H and Randy Orton in the same building, let alone in the same ring. WWE has a tendency to make people sick and tired of seeing the same two people in the ring over and over again, and that's what happened with Orton and Triple H. One of my favorite things of 2009, around that period, we saw an amazing comeback. And it was amazing in that we all knew the type of performer that Ricky the Dragon Steamboat was. Sorry about that. But to see Steamboat make a comeback to the ring in 2009, when he really has not wrestled a match since 1994, was pretty impressive stuff and completely unexpected. Nobody really knew what to expect, quite frankly, out of a guy that hasn't wrestled in God, 15 years. His career was ended on account of a back injury. Ironically, his last match up until this year was against Steve Austin in WCW. It was at I believe it was Clash of the Champions. They had more than one match, but there was one match in particular, and I think Steamboat took a bump where he fell, was shoved off the ropes and fell on his ass and hurt his back, and that was it. So we got to see Ricky Steamboat back in the ring at WrestleMania as part of a Legends Gauntlet against Chris Jericho, and Mickey Rourke was involved, and that was kind of a bust, but Steamboat and Jericho were awesome. I can't say the same about Roddy Piper and Jimmy Snuka in that match. And Steamboat went on to have an even better singles match with Jericho at Backlash the next month. I felt that really should have been the match at WrestleMania, but the comeback of Ricky Steamboat, even though it essentially died after that, was just really awesome stuff, especially if you were a Ricky Steamboat fan growing up. I was a fan. I wasn't, you know, back when I was younger, I really wasn't much into the NWA and all that, so I was aware of Steamboat, but only to a point, because his run in WWF was fairly limited. Really, really good stuff, though, and a great comeback story in a way. And I think he'd make a great guest host for Raw in the future as well. It was sad to see JBL retire this year. JBL, of course, wrestled a very short match, losing to Rey Mysterio, a good friend of his, at WrestleMania, and rode off into the sunset. JBL was actually retired, went to the announce booth on SmackDown, became an awesome color commentator on that show, and decided he was feeling well enough that his back was feeling well enough that he wanted to make a comeback, and he came back. He didn't really do much in his comeback. It was a bit of a dud, and I guess his back was still bothering him, and he realized, that's it, my time is over. He lost. He put somebody over on the way out, which is the way you're supposed to do it. And now he's playing golf all the time. I follow him on Twitter. All he does is play golf. And you know what? Good for him. You know, JBL, when he was made champion, that was a very controversial decision. When he beat Eddie Guerrero for the title in 2004 and went on, mind you, to be champion, he up until that point anyway, was the longest reigning champion in the history of SmackDown. And again, this is in an era where the title changes every other week. Looking back on it, it was pretty impressive stuff. What's more impressive is the transformation of Bradshaw from the beer-swilling acolyte and a member of the APA to John Bradshaw Layfield, who cut awesome promos, whose in-ring work was always, you know, good but nothing spectacular, but he became such an entertaining character that JBL almost became a favorite of mine. I'll even say it. And as an announcer, he was fantastic. You know, the guy may be a prick in real life. We know he was a prick to a lot of people for a lot of years, as far as the hazing and all that is concerned. You know, he acted, quite frankly, like a college kid, even in his 40s, but the career of JBL did end in 2009, so that was kind of sad. Edge, of course, who up until mid-year was one of WWE's MVPs in the company, right up there with Orton, right up there with Jericho, had a great series of matches with Jeff Hardy. I mean, they were having some great matches for months. And then at a house show match, I believe it was in June, is when he suffered an Achilles tendon injury. And Edge has been sidelined for half of 2009. He's been off television since the summer. It looks as though he may be able to make a comeback in time for WrestleMania. He may come back as a babyface to feud with Chris Jericho. It will be awesome, I think, if they go in that direction. But that depends on the healing process. This is a very frustrating injury. I know The Rock actually tore his Achilles tendon after he retired. He was filming that movie, The Game Plan, or Gridiron Gang. It was one of the football movies he made, but he suffered the injury, believe it or not. I think it was The Game Plan. He might have been doing some ballerina stuff, of all things, after a wrestling career that he pretty much stayed injury-free, and then, boom, tore his Achilles tendon. He was out for months. They had to halt production of the movie. It's the sort of thing you gotta let it heal, because if you don't and you come back and you fuck it up, you're potentially talking about a career-ending situation. And Edge has been beaten up a lot over the years, but nobody wants to see Edge end his career just yet. I think Edge has a lot more left to offer, both as a babyface and a heel. But unfortunately, the second half of 2009 in WWE was worse off without him on television. We got Chris Jericho, who had won the Unified Tag Team titles. They unified the belts. I believe they beat the Colognes. And that was around the time Edge suffered his injury. And so what I think would have been a fantastic team and probably an even greater breakup as far as the storyline between Jericho and Edge never happened. So we got Big Show plugged in as Chris Jericho's tag team partner. Again, a suspect choice at the time. Oh, my God, Big Show. But I give them credit. They really made it work. They made the tag team titles mean something at a time when the belts really don't have any business meaning anything at all, because WWE really doesn't have a tag team division. They have not taken tag teams seriously for a long, long time. They still don't have very many tag teams, but the belts do mean more now than they did then, and it's in large part because of Chris Jericho and the Big Show. And I think, you know, Jericho and the Big Show work very well together when they come out in their suits. Big Show, I'm not a fan of Big Show as an in-ring worker. He's not terribly exciting, but on the stick, and as far as his humor and his personality, Big Show is fantastic. And so the two of them played off each other very well, and, you know, they're still doing things on TV, even though they lost the belts, and I think, you know, their whole shtick may be ending. When Edge comes back, I would imagine Jericho will probably just split for good with Big Show and move on to that, but Jericho and Big Show, of all things, in 2009, their team, Jericho, one of the more refreshing things coming out of WWE in 2009. And there were other things, you know, the elevation of Kofi Kingston, which came towards the end of the year, and the elevation of Sheamus, which kind of came out of nowhere, really. And is still a work in progress, but nonetheless, it's a step in the right direction, because you need new people in the main event. Cannot just have John Cena, Undertaker, Randy Orton, Triple H, Shawn Michaels, and Batista over and over again. You've got to infuse new talent. And if it's Sheamus, then so be it. If it's Kofi Kingston, then so be it. Jack Swagger, MVP, John Morrison, Drew McIntyre, Dolph Ziggler, whoever it is, they've got to step up, and they've got to make it happen, because we're, you know, heading into 2010 and beyond, these are the guys. You know, Triple H and Undertaker and Shawn Michaels will be around in some capacity, I think, forever. But as in-ring performers, they will not be around forever. Their shelf life is very limited. They're in their 40s. They're broken down. They've been doing this for a long time. 5 years from now, who's going to be in those main events with John Cena and Randy Orton? That's the question. You've got to start planting the seeds and building those blocks now to build towards the future. Not everybody like Sheamus is going to get a push out of nowhere within 6 weeks. It has to build, and they've got a lot of talented guys in their roster. It's just a matter of how they use them. Now, one of the biggest things of 2009 was the introduction of this guest host concept on Raw. Now, this all started with a storyline. Started with a storyline that involved Donald Trump, of all people. Donald Trump, I was actually very surprised, quite frankly, agreed to come back and do a WWE storyline, this after doing the Battle of the Billionaire stuff in 2007 with Vince McMahon. I say I'm surprised because my impression was that Donald was not overly enthusiastic about doing it and all that. And not that he hated WWE or wrestling or anything like that, but I was just surprised to see him come back and do an actual storyline. He's always been a fan of the product. I mean, you know, WrestleMania 4 and 5 emanated from Trump Plaza. He was front row for those events. He's actually appeared at a couple of other WrestleManias, WrestleMania 7, WrestleMania 10, WrestleMania 20, 23, obviously. But Trump comes in, they do this storyline where he basically buys half of Raw. And it was a big storyline. It got a lot of attention, some of it for the wrong reasons in terms of their investors. I guess when you're a publicly traded company, you kind of have to tell people that it's only a storyline. And they didn't do that at first, which pissed a lot of people off and maybe even broke a few laws, but whatever. And we got our very first and probably, I'm betting, only ever commercial-free edition of Monday Night Raw, which actually did a really, really good rating. I think that edition of Raw did a 4.5 rating. You just do not hear about Raw getting a 4.5 rating anymore. That just doesn't happen. So initially, the storyline was a huge success, and the belief was that they were going to go back to Donald and say, look, this thing is really getting traction. Let's extend this. Let's keep you around for a little while longer. And either they didn't do that or Donald said, I'm out of here. I gave you a couple of weeks. That's what I promised you. I'm not here for the long term. Either way, we never really saw or heard from Trump again. They had him sell the company back at double the price to Vince, which made Vince look like a goof. And it was actually quite disappointing. There was a lot of promise and potential in that storyline again. Typical WWE, a storyline that has money written all over it, and whether it was their fault or Trump just backing out, whatever the case may be, they didn't go as far with it as they could have. But out of that came this guest host concept. As much as Vince McMahon on the air wants to take credit for it, it was really Donald Trump in storyline that came up with the concept. He said that he would have a celebrity host the show every week. Vince McMahon on TV said, well, that's a horrible idea. And lo and behold, even though Vince bought the company back, or bought Raw back, whatever it was, we started seeing guest hosts. Starting in late June, it was actually Batista, who was out injured at the time, who was the very first guest host of Raw. And we've had a couple of wrestling-related ones. The best one, I think, and I'm far from the only one, was Jesse the Body Ventura. He was actually recently. That was the Thanksgiving edition of Raw. We've had others, like Ted DiBiase, who did just an excellent job. Dusty Rhodes, was really enjoyable seeing him. Sergeant Slaughter, which, you know, didn't really do much for me. Trish Stratus, I thought, was good, but a little bit disappointing. Roddy Piper, I was at that Raw, excuse me, at Madison Square Garden last month. Again, a bit disappointing. And I know originally they had wanted Hulk Hogan for that show, and then Hogan decided to go sign with TNA, and so that went out the window. But I'm kind of torn, I guess. I think that the guest host concept has run its course. It's good in situations like what we're going to see with Bret Hart. In fact, it's almost ingenious when you think about it, because I'm not sure people like Bret Hart would even come back to WWE if it wasn't for these guest hosting gigs. The Rock, for example. The Rock has not done anything. He has not made an appearance on Raw in the ring, I believe, since 2004. He was at the Hall of Fame a couple of years ago. He did something for the 10th anniversary of SmackDown, a taped vignette, but he has not appeared in the ring in the arena in years and years and years. And the guest host thing, which The Rock has verbally agreed to do, and I believe he may be doing it in March, is a perfect way to bring these guys back. A guy like Steve Austin, who has turned down the guest hosting gig, but said if the right story presented itself, he would do it. It has to feel right. I think when it's used like that with wrestling personalities, it's great. And I think if they did it less frequently, it would mean more. There's just so many freaking awful actors out there. And I don't just mean actors. I mean any sort of celebrities. They bring them in and try to get them to act. They have to rehearse these scripted lines, and the comedy they give them to do half the time is just atrocious. Maybe it's not even their fault. Some of these people are just fucking terrible. They have no personality. They're nervous in front of a live crowd. Whatever the case may be, you almost handcuff yourself when you have to do it every single week. You've got to find people every single week, 51 weeks out of the year, because, of course, or 52 weeks, I guess. They tape TV even for the weeks where they're off the road. But I think if they did it even half that number, you know, I don't know if once a month or maybe once every other month or twice a month maybe, but I think they could stand to kind of ease it up a little bit. You don't have to have a guest host every week. Make them mean something. Try to go for some A-list celebrities. Don't keep getting the D-list people. People like Seth Green and Vern Troyer are a complete waste of my time, and they don't contribute anything to the show. Ricky Hatton, I'm sure he's a fantastic boxer and has a lot of fans in the UK. I'm sorry, but I could barely understand a word the man was saying. He's taken one too many shots to the head. These are the sort of things you have to consider when you're going to have somebody come in and host your show. And there's dialogue that they have to recite. Ozzy Osbourne, he impressed me. Ozzy was enjoyable. His wife, not so much. Bob Barker, awesome. Absolutely awesome. So anyway, what I've done here, I've put together a couple of categories. I haven't given them any fancy names. I was trying to think of some, and I just said, fuck it, just keep it simple. I think there's a total of 8 of them here. I just literally jotted them down at work. I was thinking about them. Of course, this is a very slow time of year for many companies around the holidays. Not a lot going on. So you sit there and you start to think about things. So one of the categories here that I have selected is best guest host. I guess we'll start with that one since I just talked about it. And as I mentioned a minute ago, I kind of spoiled it. My best guest. Now, again, I should preface this by saying that this is not scientific in any way. This is completely my own opinion. These are my choices, my favorites, and non-favorites. from 2009 WWE. You may have a similar list. You may disagree. Or maybe my picks match up to yours. But either way, this is my list. There was no voting involved. There was no poll that I had on my Twitter page. These are simply my opinion. So I preface this by saying that. Best guest host by a mile, Jesse Ventura. He was just awesome. I would not mind at all having Jesse back on a semi-regular basis. It's not going to happen, obviously. And even after he made his appearance, the bad blood between him and Vince McMahon sort of resumed. He made some unflattering comments. Not about the way he was treated. He said the experience that night was great. Everybody loved Jesse, and Jesse was treated very well by everybody there. But he's had issues with Vince for a long time about, you know, wrestlers not being protected and not being unionized and all that. So I don't think we'll be seeing Jesse again anytime soon. But for that one night, both as a guest host and as a commentator, calling that battle royal with Vince McMahon was one of my just favorite moments of Raw of the entire year. And Ventura just has that speaking voice, that deep speaking voice, very articulate, very intelligent. You know, didn't stumble over his lines. He didn't seem nervous. In fact, he seemed right at home. Jesse was the best. Bob Barker, in my opinion, was the second best. The guy is awesome. The guy, again, total pro. Doesn't stumble over his words. Doesn't seem nervous. Doesn't seem like he doesn't want to be there. I mean, if he didn't want to be there, he did a hell of a time masking that and hiding that. He looked like he was there to have a good time and genuinely was moved by the reaction of the people. Here's a guy that's been on television for 50 years, or had been on television for 50 years, and just is a genuinely likable man. And for a guy that's in, I believe, his 80s, he might be in his 70s, but either way, he's an older man, hasn't missed a beat, has not skipped a beat at all, and did a great job. And I thought, I really got a kick out of the whole Price is Right thing that they did. Again, they do a lot of campy, corny crap. This one, I don't know if it's because I was a fan of the Price is Right, or just I wanted to like Bob Barker so much because he seemed nice. I got a kick out of what they did that night. I thought it was funny. I thought it was cute. He would be number two on my list. Number three would be Ted DiBiase. The Million Dollar Man did an excellent job. I would, at the time, I believe I even remarked that I wouldn't mind seeing him made permanent GM for Monday Night Raw. DiBiase is great. The belly laugh is great. Hasn't missed a beat. Again, it just seems like each year that goes on, you hear that cackle, and it just sounds like it's the Million Dollar Man of old. Shaq is number four on my list. For the celebrities, he was probably among the best. He was right up there with Bob Barker. At the time, Shaq was just light years ahead of everybody else, but Shaq was one of the early guest hosts, so he didn't really have a whole lot to judge him up against. The stuff with Big Show made the highlight reels on SportsCenter, but unfortunately they never really did much to follow up with that. There was rumors of them trying to get the two of them together, him and Big Show, for a match, and of course that just did not happen, nor do I think the NBA would allow that. And number five on my list is Dusty Rhodes. The American Dream, again, did a very good job. I enjoyed the little heel turn at the end of that episode when he basically turned on John Cena. Legacy beat him up. Of course, they then turned on Dusty when Orton gave him an RKO. That was the night that Cody Rhodes had people in the crowd chanting his name, and you thought, holy shit. You know, this was almost like a Batista in Evolution moment where Randy Orton was supposed to be the golden child getting the push and going to WrestleMania against Triple H, but the fans started to take to Batista big time. And so Batista won the Royal Rumble, and he went babyface, and he beat Triple H at WrestleMania. I didn't think this would result in Cody Rhodes getting a WrestleMania-style push, but I thought, well, there's the potential here to do something. And, of course, much like with Ted DiBiase later on in the year, they did nothing to follow up on that, which was kind of a shame. So, Jesse Ventura, best guest host easily of the year. Best diva, should preface this by saying, obviously, I'm not the biggest diva wrestling fan. I think they're very attractive to look at, and they have every right to kind of compete and have their own division. But because they don't really put the focus on the divas, they give their matches very little time. There's no real storyline development. Every diva angle is the same. I think the most thought that they put into a diva angle in the last 5 years was Trish Stratus and Psycho Mickie James in 2006. I love that storyline. I actually look forward. That was one of the matches at WrestleMania 22 I was looking forward to. If they put even a little bit of effort into the women's storylines, I think they would be bigger than they are. But In any event, best diva, if I had to pick one, would be Maryse. There's something about Maryse that just, it's almost hypnotic. Maryse is a very attractive girl. I mean, you don't need me to tell you that. And there's something about her in that French accent that just, God, I'm sweating a little bit. But the best thing about Maryse are her mannerisms. She has mastered the art of being this very bitchy heel. And not bitchy in that she talks too much or complains or anything, but just she'll walk down that aisle and she'll give you such a sneer with her eyes. And that flick of the wrist, that hand gesture she has, it's just phenomenal stuff. She gets in the ring, she whips her hair back, she looks at the crowd, she smiles. Maryse is awesome. And unfortunately, she suffered a knee injury in the middle of the year. She was gone for about 3 or 4 months after she lost the women's championship. Now she's back, and I'm happy to see it. I think Maryse would actually work much better as a kind of a heel valet, maybe even managing a stable of young guys. I think as a wrestler, I guess she's okay. She's nothing great. I'm just afraid she's going to get hurt. She doesn't have a lot of experience, but Maryse is still awesome. And just by default, I'd rank Natalya probably at number 2. She doesn't get nearly the type of push she deserves, but Natalya's really good. Mickie James, who, by the way, is not fat, so let's get over that. Gail Kim, who actually has been quite disappointing since returning to WWE and leaving TNA. But I'll put her on that list at number 4. And then Melina. Now, the only reason I list Melina is because she's had some degree of success. I don't think Melina's a very good wrestler at all. In fact, I think she's pretty terrible. So, if she has to be on this list, she's at the ass end of my list, because she may be champion, she may be pushed like a superstar. She's got that, I guess, that superstar look and the great entrance, and she's very flexible, and that's all fine and good, but as a wrestler, she's going to kill somebody or kill herself one day, and that's not something I want to see. So, Maryse, by a mile, best diva of 2009. By the way, I was quite sad to see them break up the Miz-Maryse combo. I mean, they were never actually together, but they were kind of going in that direction. And when Maryse got hurt, they decided to have Miz basically dump her, and they never went anywhere with it. I think Maryse as a valet for the Miz, of all people, has money written all over it. And I'm hoping that at some point they may revisit that. Best angle or storyline? This is going to be, to me, you have to go with Donald Trump buying Raw. Even though the follow-up on it was non-existent, there was, I think, a lot of different ways they could have gone with this, and in many ways they dropped the ball. Again, whether it was their fault or just Trump didn't want to cooperate, I don't know. But it was a big deal, and it got a lot of press attention and a lot of people very excited, and it kind of came out of nowhere in a way. Nobody, you know, it wasn't WrestleMania time. They weren't building to a big pay-per-view or anything like that, but it definitely stirred up some attention. So I put that on there as, you know, best or maybe most creative storyline. I have Orton punting Vince McMahon and kissing Stephanie, basically Orton fucking around with the McMahons at the beginning of the year in number 2. Again, and this seems to be a developing pattern here, it's just a case of missed potential. There was so much they could have done here to capitalize on this, and then they went the campy road with Triple H breaking into his home, and then things just got boring. It just became like every other Triple H Randy Orton feud. It got to the point where I just did not want to see them anymore. And, you know, for a guy that punted the owner of the company in the skull and then basically sexually, you know, harassed his daughter, Randy Orton got off pretty scot-free. He walks around like a free man every week, and nobody seems to care, so that suspension of disbelief is really being tested in situations like that. But it was still, at the time, before it got all fucked up, it was really good stuff. And number 3, as this is going to be a top 3 here, Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. The build-up to their match was great. Again, missed potential. You have a story that goes back to 1997. These guys were in a blood feud with each other. They had some of the best matches of that decade in WWE. And you have the built-in story of Shawn Michaels' career being grinded to a halt as a result of an injury sustained at the hands of The Undertaker in that casket match back in 1998 at the Royal Rumble. Of course, I will admit, they dropped the ball on this many years ago because the time to do something like that would have been shortly after Shawn made his comeback in 2002. And it would have looked a little weird if, after all these years back, 7 years or so, for Shawn Michaels in 2009 to be like, hey, you're the guy who ended my career. But you know what? I would have went with it anyway, because it was such a good story, because it was real. The guy really got hurt in a match with The Undertaker, and The Undertaker didn't seem to care. Shawn Michaels lost 4.5 years of his career because of The Undertaker backdropping him out of the ring. They played that up very little, if at all. I think it was mentioned in passing. That was disappointing. In spite of that, the build-up was great. Two old-school guys playing mind games with each other. I ate that up like a chicken dinner. I loved it. It was great. And, of course, the match more than delivered. As far as storylines and match build-ups, that was among the best of 2009. So that would be my best angle-slash-storyline of the year. Most annoying. That's the name of the category. Most annoying. Easily, the winner of this category is Michael Cole. I cannot stand Michael Cole. Now, this is not to say that Michael Cole is not a talented guy. There is some semblance of a good wrestling announcer buried deep within his soul. Maybe he is not allowed to be the way that he would like to be and say the things he would like to say. In fact, I know that that's at least to some degree true, and I feel kind of sorry for him. But he is awful. This experiment with him as the lead announcer on Raw is a failure. He is annoying. He brings down the broadcast, and it doesn't help that he's become a punchline. This is your lead announcer on your flagship show. This would be the equivalent of NBC having Al Michaels do Monday Night Football. Well, I guess it's Sunday Night Football now, but do their football broadcasts on Sunday nights with his underwear on his head, like he's some demented person with Alzheimer's disease, and just kind of poke fun at him and make fun of him. Or John Madden on the air, when he was on the air, eating chicken wings on the air, you know, big drums of chicken, you know, playing off how fat he is. Everybody loves to play off how Michael Cole is such a nerd. Oh, Michael Cole is this, Michael Cole is that. Look at him again. He's throwing up on Chris Jericho's shoe. He's jumping up and down. He wants to slam me. He's hugging the fat, oily guy. This is the face of Raw. Let's be honest. This is your lead announcer. And they make him out to be an absolute joke. Nobody takes him seriously. And for good reason, because it's very hard to do that. But this experiment is a failure. Jim Ross was kidnapped and taken to the SmackDown brand in June of 08. We're now headed into 2010, and Jim Ross has had his issues. He's been off TV now for a while. He won't be back at least until March. But, having said that, there needs to be a replacement. Wait until JR feels better. Work it into a storyline. I don't care. Jim Ross needs to be back on Monday Night Raw. And I think he will. I think when Jim Ross comes back, I think he's going to Raw. I haven't heard that from anybody. I haven't read that anywhere, but he has to come back to Raw. And I think those comments that Michael Cole made at the Slammies, which were scripted for him, and I can't fault Michael Cole for that too much, but I can't help but think that that's going to be part of some sort of storyline. But Michael Cole and the fake laughing and the guffawing, and Jerry Lawler is guilty of this too, but I'll give him a pass because I'm sure he's just doing what he's told. Jerry Lawler just goes, he shows up for work, he doesn't give a shit. He just does what he's told, collects his paycheck, and goes home. Can't fault the guy for that. Michael Cole just takes it to a whole new level. So he wins the award by 5 miles. The Chavo Guerrero Hornswoggle stuff on Raw was almost as annoying. Not quite as annoying as Michael Cole, but it was still bad stuff. And it looks like they finally, we haven't seen Chavo and Hornswoggle in a few weeks now, and I guess they could always revisit it here and there, but thank God that running joke, that storyline appears to be over. It literally went on for months. The one good thing about it was that it got Chavo Guerrero TV time, but the problem is that, again, this is my list, my opinion, I don't give a shit about Chavo Guerrero. I really don't. He's been a jobber for so long. And he's older, and he doesn't, when he was younger, he was impressive. He was in the cruiserweight division in WCW and did some impressive stuff, and now he's old, and I just don't care. So, him being on Raw did nothing for me. It was a channel changer. Him and Hornswoggle just took it to a whole new level of suck. Thank God Chavo and Hornswoggle is over. DX is number 3 on my list. Now, DX has their moments, and they have, some pretty funny interplay together sometimes. But this is not the DX of old. This DX is very annoying. Or they can be very annoying. It depends on the material that's given to them. Plugging their merchandise, and I understand they want to sell merchandise, that's how they make their bread and butter, but it gets to a point where it's like, alright, I get the joke, enough is enough, and they just keep making more merchandise. You know, the hats and the t-shirts were bad enough, now we have the book, now we have the Snuggies, now we have that stupid fucking thing that Shawn Michaels wears around his neck, I keep thinking that he got bit by a vampire. I don't know what kind of merchandise they've got in the pipeline for DX. I cannot wait until DX splits. I cannot wait for Triple H to take a sledgehammer to Shawn Michaels and just go heel and end this DX charade once and for all. Or for Bret Hart to come in and just obliterate them. So DX, for all their good, is also very annoying, and they're number three on my list. Number four is Dr. Ken. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. August 3rd, 2009, a day of infamy. Jeremy Piven, guest hosting Raw. Who is with Jeremy Piven? Why, it's his guest star from that shitty movie he made about the goods or something, where he's a used car dealer. Dr. Ken, same guy from The Hangover, as Jerry Lawler pointed out to us that night, at least once. This guy, you talk about annoying. I did think about putting him in the number one spot, but Michael Cole, the thing about Dr. Ken, it was just 1 week. Michael Cole, we have to listen to him every week. The DX crap, we get every week. Dr. Ken, at least, was one night. It was an isolated incident. But it was pretty bad. And it was almost apropos for him to get dumped on his head the way he did at the end of that show, and that he didn't suffer a concussion in the process. It was just a disaster. It's one thing to be a little bit annoying to get some heat, but he took it to a whole new level. I don't even want to think about it. If you didn't see it, thank your lucky stars. You're better off for it. It was pretty, pretty bad. And number five, I just put Sharon Osbourne, because Ozzy was great, but Sharon was annoying with that really stuff with The Miz, and now The Miz seems to have adopted that as like a catchphrase, that really, and I just think that that really sucks. Breakout Star of the Year. This was a tough one. I've got four guys on my list. And I know there were others. Actually, I got five. I'm sorry. I do have five. I put Yoshitatsu at number five. You know, you can't really put him higher than that because he's on ECW and nobody cares. I put Sheamus at number four, actually below Drew McIntyre. And the reason I did that, even though Sheamus is WWE champion, and he's been around, I guess, on ECW since July, I believe, when he was feuding with Goldust, of all people. Sheamus just got the belt. It was the very end of the year. I can't, you know, you're judging things in an entire calendar year. Sheamus has been hot for a month, if that, so I can't really put him higher than that. Drew McIntyre I put higher just because he's been on SmackDown for longer, and again, he's one of Triple H's chosen few, and now he's the Intercontinental Champion, and so Drew McIntyre's number three. Now, the top two slots, it was very, very close. It was almost a tie for first place, but a tie would be kind of lame, so I had to pick one. I put The Miz at number two on my list, and I almost put him at number one. And the reason is this. The Miz has done a remarkable job in 2009 of making himself a credible, believable, relevant singles mid-carder. Obviously, he's the United States champion now, but let's be honest, the United States title doesn't mean anything. It means dick. It's bad enough none of the titles really mean much at all. The U.S. title means less than that. Maybe The Miz can help restore some credibility to it. He's had it for a little while now, but it's not about that so much. The company clearly has faith in him in that they put a belt on him. They did put him, he had a cup of coffee with John Cena in that program. He called out Cena for weeks and weeks and weeks and claimed he went, I think, 6-0 at one point. John Cena refused to answer his challenges. Cena finally came out. And then it all went downhill from there because John Cena basically didn't take The Miz seriously. He even said as much in some of his promos, and then he beat him pretty decisively on pay-per-view, and that was the end of that. So, on the one hand, it was great to see him kind of mix it up with the main eventer, but on the other hand, they made Miz look like a jobber. But Miz has done a pretty good job of rebounding. He's got a couple of catchphrases that the crowd chants along with. He's very, very good on the mic. And this is where the differences come in with him and John Morrison, who didn't even make my list, by the way. And Morrison's great in the ring, but Morrison is one of the worst talkers in WWE who actually gets a microphone. He is awful. And I think he will improve over time. But when you look at Miz and Morrison, it's kind of interesting because when they broke them up, conventional wisdom was that Morrison was going to be the Shawn Michaels of the team. And Miz was going to be the Marty Jannetty. And they even did a little storyline like that earlier this year. And they had Jannetty come back on Raw and lose to the Miz. But it's kind of unfair to Marty in that Marty was always... In fact, Marty was probably as talented as Shawn Michaels, but Marty had his own demons. He partied too much and all that, and he blew a lot of chances over the years, and that's really why Marty Jannetty never got higher than he did. But, well, he got high, but that's not what I meant. Anyway, The Miz, I think a lot of people felt, was kind of going to follow the same path. Not that he partied too much and had demons to fight off, but that he was going to be forgotten, and that breaking up that Miz and Morrison tandem was going to be suicide for The Miz. It's almost been a complete role reversal. Not completely. I mean, Morrison had a pretty good reign as Intercontinental Champion up until recently. And he's, you know, he's an upper guy on SmackDown. I think at some point he will be a bona fide main eventer. Morrison is one of those guys who in 5 years is going to be, you know, in a position like John Cena or Randy Orton would be on the show. I firmly believe that. If he can stay injury free. Now, The Miz is awesome on the microphone. I mean, when The Miz says he's awesome, he really is. He's smooth. His delivery is flawless. It doesn't sound like he's rehearsing lines. He sounds like a pretentious prick, which is the point. That's his role. You know, when you look at the background that Miz has coming from that reality TV show background, a lot of people didn't take him seriously. And he had a lot of enemies backstage in WWE. Not enemies, I guess, but people who, again, didn't take him seriously, wanted him to pay his dues. They looked at him as a joke and nothing more. The Miz has proven everybody wrong. The Miz is not a joke. The Miz is a very credible mid-card performer in WWE with a belt who I think has the potential to go even higher. Is he a future world champion like Morrison? I don't see why he couldn't be. I don't see him becoming a world champion, but that I think is more of a size issue with Vince McMahon. The Miz is a little smaller than John Morrison, but The Miz really impressed me. He really opened a lot of eyes, including my own, this year. And for that reason alone, I almost put him in the number one spot. But I decided to put Kofi Kingston at number one. Now, Miz has been impressing me for, you know, at least half the year, a nice chunk of the year. And the Kofi stuff is really only picked up towards the end of 2009. But even before Kofi dropped the accent and got into the feud with Orton, he had a pretty lengthy run as a U.S. champion. In fact, I believe he beat Chris Jericho for the belt in June. I could be wrong about this. And held it up until September, October. Which, in today's day and age, is like a Bruno Sammartino reign. So he was already getting a push. But again, as long as you're a U.S. champion, it's almost like, you know, a hamster wheel. You're just going to keep going in motions. You're not going to go anywhere. When they decided to drop the Jamaican accent and I heard Kofi start cutting promos, I was very impressed. Because Kofi, again, is a very articulate speaker, very clear, very easy to understand, and he seems like a natural on the mic. And the thing about Kofi is that it's not just that he has good mic skills, but he's some big galoot who can't wrestle or is very green. He is a great wrestler. He can do things in that ring not too many other people can do, very much like John Morrison, and he can combine great wrestling skills with great mic skills. In many respects, it's almost like he's the total package. Whereas a guy like Morrison, as great as he is still pretty bad on the mic. He's improving, but he's pretty bad. So that's certainly a mark in Kofi's favor. But looking at what they've done with him up until recently anyway, the stuff... I was at Madison Square Garden when he did that dive on Orton, and they had their big brawl. The fans in Madison Square Garden were chanting the guy's name. He's standing on the railing over a broken and battered Randy Orton. They're chanting Kofi, 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 Kofi. And I thought, wow, a star is born. A star is born. And I really hope that that's true, because I think there's a lot of potential there. And I would put Kofi at number one as far as breakout star of the year. There's been a few people that have broken out. The Miz, like I said, it was very, very close. I think you could have gone either way. I think I could have put The Miz at one, Kofi at two, but I decided to give Kofi the edge and put him at number one. Best pay-per-view, not really much of a category. I pick WrestleMania 25 by default. Not just because it's WrestleMania, although that certainly helps, but the combination of the Shawn Michaels-Undertaker match with the Money in the Bank match, which was also a quality match, and getting to see Ricky Steamboat come back for the first time against Chris Jericho in that gauntlet was enough to make WrestleMania, to me, the best pay-per-view overall of 2009. number two on the list, I'd put The Bash as a runner-up, which is interesting because The Bash, if I remember correctly, was kind of the lost, forgotten pay-per-view. It was, I think, 2 weeks after another pay-per-view, and they literally did not start hyping matches for it until, like, literally days beforehand. And so, naturally, there turned out to be a couple of quality matches on that card, including Chris Jericho and Rey Mysterio, and what was the main event? You had CM Punk and Jeff Hardy, that's right, and Orton and Triple H. But I will say they had a good, that was that Three Stages of Hell match. So, overall, The Bash was actually a damn good event, which is, again, is funny considering that they did less for The Bash than any other pay-per-view this year in terms of promoting it. And probably number three, just to make it a top three, I'd put Royal Rumble just because I watch the Rumble, and I always enjoy the Rumble. It was a good Rumble match. Orton won, but, yeah, that's the best pay-per-view category. Again, tough to judge because I'm not watching all the pay-per-views anymore, and because the pay-per-views overall, from top to bottom, it's very hard to find a pay-per-view show that's really, truly great. TLC was a good pay-per-view recently, but it was good. It wasn't overly, you know, spectacular or anything like that. Match of the Year. Boy, if this is your first time listening to the Sound Off, I'll give you a pass. But anybody who's listened to more than three episodes of the show probably don't even need me to tell you what's number one. So I'll work my way back. It'll be a top five list. Number five, I put Jeff Hardy and CM Punk in the TLC match at SummerSlam. I thought it was a really good match, really good. The right person won. A lot of people figured Punk was winning anyway because Jeff was on his way out. They had a good cage match, by the way, on SmackDown that week when Punk retired Jeff as well, but I thought the TLC match was really good, and the Undertaker thing at the end, when he came back and was kind of laying underneath Punk, it wasn't technically part of the match, it was post-match, but I lump it in there together. That was really cool. It really worked, and it was a cool visual, and so that's number five on my list. Number four, I have, believe it or not, John Cena and Randy Orton. Their match at Breaking Point in September, I happened to see. And I thought it was a really good match. In fact, it was probably the best Orton-Cena match of the year. Better than Hell in a Cell, better than Bragging Rights, which, by the way, I thought that Iron Man match was really good. It was definitely not the best Iron Man match. It wasn't even close to being the best Iron Man match I've ever seen. But I call it like I see it. That was a good match. This one was better. Watching the visual of Orton having Cena, who was cuffed, kind of hanging from the posts on the outside of the ring and just obliterating him with Singapore cane shots was disturbing, and it was something that I think I liked in part because it was truly extreme in that you don't see stuff like that too often on WWE television. There was no blood, but it was pretty brutal stuff, more brutal than you'd see. Orton tapped. I thought Orton tapped a little too quickly at the end, but. It was a really good match, and I remember watching it. It was the first and only time I've ever seen a John Cena-Randy Orton match and thought, wow, I wish the match would have been even longer. I thought the match would have gone on another 5 or 10 minutes. So I gotta call it like I see it, and that's on my list at number four. Now, number three, John Morrison and Rey Mysterio from SmackDown. This was September 4th. This was when Mysterio was about to start serving a 30-day suspension for a violation of the wellness policy. And he was the Intercontinental Champion at the time, and they had to get the belt off of him. And so they decided that they were going to put him in the ring with Morrison and put Morrison over. And I thought this was an excellent match. Just one of the best matches on SmackDown all year, if not the best. And I think SmackDown had more quality matches in the ring than Raw did, so that's saying a lot. They had a tremendous match. Great chemistry. Morrison won. And was put over very strongly in the process, won the Intercontinental Championship, and it was one of the best matches of the year. Number three on my list. Number two, I put Chris Jericho and Rey Mysterio from The Bash, which I just talked about. Really, it's almost interchangeable, I think, because Jericho and Mysterio, any match they had this year was awesome. I enjoyed that whole storyline. For years, actually, I was hoping for a Jericho-Mysterio feud, and finally got it this year, and they did not disappoint. This was the match, I believe, that ended the feud, the one where Jericho yanked off Rey's mask only to reveal another one, and Rey ended up beating him. And if I remember correctly, it was slightly better than the match they had at Extreme Rules, but like I said, they're all interchangeable. They had some great matches. That was the one I think I enjoyed the most. That's number two on my list. And number one, I think it goes without saying, and this would probably be the same for a lot of your lists. Not everybody feels the same way, but I just do not see how you can rank any WWE match this year ahead of Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. They take the number one spot without any competition whatsoever. As Jim Ross said on commentary that night, one of the great quotes from WrestleMania this year, as a wrestling fan, how could you ask for anything more? This match not only lived up to expectations, it exceeded it, and I'll tell you why. We have not seen a Shawn Michaels one-on-one match with The Undertaker since 1998, which was actually the worst of the three they had in that 97-98 period. I thought the Ground Zero match and the Hell in a Cell match at Bad Blood were far better than the casket match. But they worked well together. We knew this. It had been, 12 years almost, since we last saw them one-on-one in the ring. We've had teases over the years. The 2007 Royal Rumble, it came down to the two men. They had a great brawl until Undertaker dumped them out of the ring. In 2008, Madison Square Garden, I was there. Again, Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker went at it in the Royal Rumble match for a bit, but we never actually got the match we wanted. Michaels has been back since 2002. Far too long to not have had this match, but we finally got it this year. The build-up was great, not perfect, but great. And what made the match so great was not just that as a wrestling match it was really, really good. As a wrestling match, just judged on that in terms of the in-ring work, it was by no means the best match I've ever seen. It was still a damn good wrestling match. What made it a phenomenal wrestling match was the combination of the fact that it was a good match and the emotion and the storytelling that went into it. And the crowd reaction certainly helped. The crowd was going apeshit for this match. It was just really good. I cannot find anything negative other than Undertaker's dive, which I'm thinking maybe he should retire, and I'm guessing he won't do that. I don't mean Undertaker should retire. I mean he should retire the move where he just dives over the top rope, soars over the top rope like an eagle. And he almost broke his neck and died. In fact, there were people in the arena who were taken out of the match completely because from their vantage point in the arena, at Reliant Stadium, they thought Undertaker had died. And even on TV, it looked pretty bad. That killed it for a couple of minutes. But when we realized Undertaker was not dead or critically injured, we kind of got back into the match at that point. It was almost like, okay, wipe your brow, he's okay, and we're going to move on here. Now, Undertaker would say later on, I believe he suffered a concussion. He was definitely groggy after that. How he was able to continue on, remember all of his spots and not miss a beat, I'll never know. Kurt Angle is notorious for doing that in matches, but it was just one of those things where I don't know that anybody really thought Shawn Michaels would be the one to end the Undertaker streak, because I don't think the streak will ever end. But they did such a great job in the match that for the near falls, as the match went on, even I bought into the fact that, holy shit, Shawn Michaels is about to end this streak. Kick out, kick out, kick out. I didn't sit there going, it doesn't matter because we know Undertaker's going to win. I was hooked. They hooked me. It worked. And I'm not the only one. I'll never forget that priceless image of Undertaker's face when Shawn Michaels kicked out of the first tombstone, which in my opinion was the best part of the match. When he was skinning the cat and Undertaker turned it into a tombstone and he kicked out and the place went bonkers and the announcers, JR went orgasmic. He probably went it was overkill, but still, it was great. It was such a great moment. And again, you just don't see people kick out of the tombstone. So when somebody does, people notice it, and it means something. After the second tombstone, I knew it was over, and I applauded from my living room. That's how great this match was. I don't think any match this year in WWE has put as big of a smile on my face as this one. And it's one of those rare occasions when the match lives up to expectations. I ranted and raved on this podcast for months and months and months and months about how I wanted to see a Shawn Michaels Undertaker match. And we finally got it, and I can honestly say I was happy. There's nothing for me to complain about. It was great. They're teasing it now for WrestleMania 26. Something tells me that we're not going to get it. It's a swerve, something else. And maybe with Bret Hart coming in, maybe plans change even more and they want to put Shawn in another match. I don't know. Maybe we will get it. If we do, I question how they're ever going to be able to top that match from last year. But nonetheless, it was great. It was great. And it was easily the match of the year in World Wrestling Entertainment. Now, I actually have two other matches listed here as honorable mentions. If this was a top seven, I did have Jericho and Steamboat from Backlash, which I mentioned earlier. As a straight singles match, it was great. I mean, Ricky Steamboat, seeing him do his thing in that ring in 2009 was surreal. And just a personal thing, I put the Chris Jericho Big Show versus DX versus Cena Undertaker triple threat tag match from Raw at Madison Square Garden back on November 16th. I was at that show. And just based, so much star power in that match and being able to see, again, even briefly, Michaels and Undertaker in the ring. And it was a brief match. I don't think it went more than 8 or 9 minutes, but it's just a personal favorite of mine for the year because I was there. And it was great. So those are your top matches for 2009. And the last category here, of course, Superstar of the Year. This is another close one, but a little more decisive than the breakout superstar category. Again, I'll start backwards here. Number 5 on my list is Christian. I think Christian is incredibly underutilized and underappreciated in WWE. I think he's got bigger things in the future for him. Unfortunately, he's not higher on this list because he's been floundering on the ECW brand, but he's on the list ahead of a lot of other people. And he's on that list because he has done such a phenomenal job. He puts his game face on. He doesn't complain. He goes out there week after week. He works with great talents. He works with talents that are not so great. And he always has a great match. Very rarely will you see Christian in a bad match. He has made the ECW title mean something to some people. It still means nothing to me, but that's not Christian's fault. It's just because the ECW title is worthless. And WWE clearly doesn't care about it, so why should I? But he has carried that brand on his back for virtually the entire year since he made his re-debut. And for that reason alone, he has to be on this list. Number 4, I have CM Punk. Obviously, Punk really broke out in 2008 when he cashed in Money in the Bank and won the world title for the first time, but Punk finally went heel this year. And again, go back and listen to the old sound-offs. Maybe even from last year, when I would talk over and over and over again about the work I saw Punk do in Ring of Honor and how, as good as he was as a babyface, he could be light years better as a heel, especially the straight edge heel. And that's exactly what they've done. And Punk is great. Now, Punk is not getting pushed very hard. That's not his fault. Again, that's more politics than anything else. But the cream always rises to the top. Punk is a former, I think, 3-time world champion. Now, he'll be back up in that upper echelon eventually. But Punk has been doing a phenomenal job. And Punk, over the summer, had a series of fantastic matches with Jeff Hardy. I mean, just fantastic matches. It may have been Feud of the Year in WWE. Just great, great stuff. Speaking of which, Jeff Hardy would be number 3 on my list. Now, Jeff left in September, and he's fallen on some tough times since then. But Jeff was around for most of the year, and again, Jeff was a stellar performer. His feud with Edge yielded some great matches, including their ladder match. At the Extreme Rules pay-per-view, which I thought was a really good match, nothing great, just because to me, at points, it seemed just like a collection of spots more than just a wrestling match. But they, you know, Jeff and Edge had some great matches. Jeff and Punk had some great matches, and Jeff really did a lot to put Punk over as a main event player. He really did. On his way out, Jeff did what everybody should do. Just like in the old days when you would leave a territory, you put the guy over. And he put Punk over big time and made him seem like a real star. And Jeff Hardy should be commended for that. And not just for that, but also, you know, Jeff did not tone it down. He didn't dial it back, even though he knew he was leaving. If anything, he turned it up a couple of notches. And at the end of his run, before he retired for now, he put out some of his best performances of his WWE career. He is to be commended for that. Regardless of what happened after that, he is to be commended for that. Chris Jericho is number 2 on my list. He probably would have been number 1 last year, and he's still up there this year. But Jericho, I don't want to say he was brought down by doing the tag team thing, because I think him and Big Show did such a great job together. But he was more of a tag wrestler for half the year than a singles guy, and maybe that's why I couldn't put him at number 1. But, I mean, Jericho is still awesome. Him being off of Raw is the worst thing that could happen for Raw. So even though they're going back on the stipulation by having Jericho already trying to get back on the Raw show, I'm in favor of it. I'm all for it. Raw is much better with Chris Jericho on there. And he really, in many ways, he was the MVP of the Raw show, but just overall, best superstar of the year. I'm going to give it to Randy Orton. Orton as a performer, compared to even 2 years ago, you look back at his Evolution days, obviously he was younger, and that was one of the whole points of putting him in Evolution in the first place, because they knew, or Triple H felt, that this guy's going to be a main event player that's going to carry this company for years and years, and so let's give him the seasoning that he needs. I think Evolution was good for Orton. Hanging around Flair and Triple H was good for Orton. But just to see where he's come in the last 2 or 3 years as a performer, I don't just mean as an in-ring wrestler. I mean as a performer. His mannerisms, the way he cocks his head, the way he moves, the way he slithers around in the ring, pounds on the ground. He takes his time. He slows down the pace. He's not like some of these, you know, the smaller guys who feel compelled. And you see a lot of this, I guess, on independents. Even independents that I don't watch, you know, I see independent reports submitted to wrestling websites that say, you know, this guy did all kinds of flips and stupid shit onto thumbtacks and this and that, and it makes you shake your head. I watch Ring of Honor, which I think is a great product, and when I watch it, as great as it is, the guys are moving at a million miles an hour. Orton is almost old school in that respect. He slows down the pace, but he's very, very good at what he does. He's very methodical. Now, some people mistake that for being boring, and you know, he's had some matches that are boring, but overall, I think Randy Orton is fantastic. And Randy Orton is the kind of guy that can have a match of the year. I don't think him and Kofi Kingston have had their best match yet. I think there's the potential for them to have a match of the year type candidate if they're given the time and given the chance. Orton had a bazillion matches with John Cena. If I never see Randy Orton versus John Cena again, I'll die a happy man. But they had some good matches. I even listed their match on my best match list of 09. Their breaking point match, the submission match, was excellent stuff. They told a great story in that match. I think, again, DiBiase and Rhodes being aligned with Orton, I can't say that it's helped DiBiase and Rhodes tremendously, because DiBiase and Rhodes they're not really any higher up than they were 6 months ago. But that's not Randy Orton's fault. I think they're much better for having worked and learned from Orton. I just think these start and stop pushes, you know, DiBiase, when they did that whole deal many, many weeks ago on Raw that they seemingly forgot, where DiBiase was standing up to Orton and the crowd was popping for him. And you thought, wow, here comes the face turn. And then they just dropped the whole damn thing. It's infuriating. But not Orton's fault. You know, he's done a great job. He really has. And he hasn't gotten into trouble, which was a problem for him. A lot of people didn't know how long Randy Orton was going to be in the company, quite frankly. He's got one wellness strike against him. He really should have two. I don't know what the deal is there, but that's neither here nor there. But you really don't, or at least the last couple of months, you haven't heard any stories about Orton flying off the handle, because he was known to have a short fuse, or failing a drug test or anything like that. He's behaved. He has done a good job of putting over Kofi Kingston. The writing team has kind of dropped the ball recently. But Orton has been doing everything that's been asked of him, and he's very, very good at it. And so, to me, Randy Orton is your Superstar of the Year for 2009. And on that note, those are the categories I jotted down. Again, just a quick little thing. I felt the Slammies were so bad, I had to give you my own. Kind of a year in review here on the Sound Off. It's been a good year. Not a great year, but a good year. And hopefully 2010 will bring even better joy for wrestling fans. And, you know, January 4th is a big night. It's a big night for TNA. I really hope they temper their expectations. They're not going to beat WWE out of the gate. But there is the potential for TNA to kind of change their ways, make some headway, bring in some big names, and try to become a real competitor in 2010. And WWE, you know, with Bret Hart coming in, to me that's really exciting. I'm curious to see where they go with that. They've got younger guys that are starting, finally, to be given the ball to run with, and, you know, whether or not they get their legs cut off from underneath them remains to be seen, but Sheamus, I think, can grow into the role he's in now. Kofi Kingston is on the cusp of something big. The Miz, I think, has big things in his future. Drew McIntyre, John Morrison, Evan Bourne, even. You know, Evan Bourne is fond of the Leaf, so to speak. Which is one of the reasons he has been not even de-pushed. He just doesn't get pushed on Raw. Marijuana usage is a big problem on the Raw side, from what I understand. The SmackDown side is fine. On the Raw side, I don't want to say everybody's doing it, but people are getting fined left and right. It's a big problem. And Evan Bourne is part of that problem. But I think Evan Bourne, if he can kind of get that under control and not have a reputation, I guess, for doing that sort of thing. As small as he is, he's not going to be a world champion. He'll never be a world champion working for WWE, but he can be a big star. He's an exciting guy to watch. They've got guys coming up in developmental. Caval, formerly known as Low Key, I think he'll be brought up to the roster in 2010. Bryan Danielson is still waiting in the wings, former Ring of Honor champion. He's under contract to WWE and getting paid. He's just waiting around to get that phone call to come in and do something. And I think if they handle Danielson right, he could be a big star too. I don't have a lot of faith in that, but I guess we'll see. 2010, a lot of those questions will be answered. So if you have a list any favorite matches or moments or whatnot of 2009, or you want to argue my list or agree with my list and leave some feedback for me, make me feel good this holiday season, I'd appreciate that. My email address, as always, is thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/solemonster, and if you do that, I will give you a cookie. So I do appreciate it. And in all seriousness, I want to just say I really do appreciate everybody who downloads this show and listens to this show, whether it's every week or every so often, even the ones who hate me, and thank God there's only a couple of those people, but whether you love me or hate me, you listen to the show, and I really appreciate that. We've built up a nice audience here on SEScoops.com that hopefully will continue to grow into 2010 and beyond as we approach our 100th episode, and hopefully another 100 after that. And this holiday season, do be well, as I always say. Do stay safe. If you celebrate Christmas, if you don't celebrate Christmas, whatever it is you celebrate, if you celebrate Festivus with an aluminum pole, that's fine too. The feats of strength and all that, that's great. Whatever you do, do enjoy it. Have a happy new year. There may be another sound off before 2010. Next weekend, this is your fill for this weekend. But there may be one more before the January 4th showdown. I'm planning on there being one more. I can't guarantee that. But whenever the next time is that we are back with you here, do enjoy the holidays. Do have a happy and healthy new year. And until next time, this is the Solemonster. Keep it locked in right here to SEScoops.com. Thank you all.